Well, if I can pull up the chair, I think I can handle this. All right. All right, welcome to the Court of Appeals for the Second District. This is the case of Brian K. Herron and Susan K. Herron, formerly known as Susan C. Carley, versus Wells Fargo Bank. And the document I've got here shows 15 minutes for opening argument for the appellant, 15 minutes for rebuttal, and 5 minutes for rebuttal from the appellant. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Okie doke. You ready to go?
Yes,
sir. Good. Lead off.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
And Merry Christmas,
Jerry. Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you.
May it please the court. My name's Jack Peacock, and I'm here representing Mr. and Mrs. Herron in this appeal. And as the court knows, this is an MSJ case. The case was decided against Mr. and Mrs. Herron by summary judgment in the lower court. The case turned largely on the judicial estoppel argument that Wells Fargo made. But this case is different from any other judicial estoppel case that I could find. And I looked at, I believe, all the cases that dealt with that. And this one is different. And so let me get to the heart of it.
Tell us how it differs, please.
Yes. In this case, we were not the plaintiffs in the court below. We were the defendants. Wells Fargo sued us. They sued us, and the basis of their suit was that the foreclosure that they had done was invalid. That was the basis of their lawsuit. It's matter of fact, in the record, it's the very first document, their lawsuit. We filed an answer to the lawsuit, and basically our answer is, you're right, it was invalid. And these are the reasons why that it was invalid. So in a few interesting twists, then Wells Fargo took the position that, well, Herons, you can't raise the fact that the foreclosure sale was no good because you're estopped. You're judicially estopped. Well, they filed their motion for summary judgment. The court granted it. And then what do? They non-suit their lawsuit. But they've got a few problems there. Number one, their lawsuit is a judicial admission to start with. They admitted the fact in the record that the foreclosure was no good. And then used an extraordinary remedy like judicial estoppel to get a summary judgment against our claim, which was the same claim. So that's number one. This case is very extraordinary in that sense. I scoured the record and the cases, and I find none where a scenario procedurally was done like this. So basically, a few facts. Number one, the Herons purchased this property approximately 12 years ago, and they took out an FHA loan. Subsequent to that, they had some job loss, and Mrs. Herron had severe medical problems, lost an unborn child, and had extreme medical expenses. Well, so ultimately they wound up in bankruptcy, trying to preserve their home, and in their bankruptcy schedules, they mentioned the fact that they own this property, that it's exempt property, et cetera, et cetera. All that's in the schedules and all that's in the record. Subsequent to that, because of continuous financial problems, they got behind with their trustee payments and their payments during the course of the bankruptcy. And so Wells Fargo filed a motion to lift the stay. Of course, all of this happened before the loss, before they ever filed their lawsuit against my clients. And so an agreed order was entered into. That's in the record also. And you will note from the record that, number one, it's an agreement. It forms the basis of an agreement. And number two, it was an order. Part of that order was that if Wells Fargo is going to be able to lift the stay, they have to give the Herons the opportunity to cure the problem. And that has to happen twice before the stay's lifted. Well, we all know from the record that that they lifted the stay before the second opportunity. So they jumped the gun. They admit it, it's in the record, and then they foreclosed, and the foreclosure, of course, was problematic by their own admission in their pleadings. So what happened after the foreclosure? Well, my clients, now they're still in bankruptcy. A plan has been confirmed long before that. And during that time, while they're still in bankruptcy and they've been foreclosed now, and they're trying to get this issue resolved. Well, it's also in the record that Wells Fargo agreed that they had a problem and that they were going to try to work out a rescission. As a matter of fact, their proposed rescission is even attached in the record. The Herons were in favor, certainly, of setting aside the foreclosure sale, but they were not in agreement with the amount of money that Wells Fargo was saying that they still owed. So there was a problem there, and there was ongoing work to try to get that resolved. Well, after 5 months after the foreclosure, Wells Fargo sues my clients and alleges that the foreclosure is no good. As a matter of fact, they say in part on page 8 of the record, in which is in their lawsuit where they have causes of action, the heading is declaratory judgment to establish plaintiff's lien. Now remember, this is after the foreclosure, and they say, for this cause of action, plaintiffs adopt by reference the above paragraphs of this petition. Plaintiff seeks a declaratory judgment that the foreclosure sale on July 5th, 2011 is void. Not just voidable, but void. And that the substitute trustee's deed filed of record in under document number D211164479 be purged from the official real property records of Tarrant County, Texas, and that the plaintiff retains a subsisting and valid lien. Well, the difference in this case and the Flores case, for example, which the court decided several months ago, was that Flores, of course, made the contention in his lawsuit after the bankruptcy that the lien was no good. But he had, in his bankruptcy, said it was good. So that was clearly an inconsistent position that he took.
And they reaffirm the debt in this case, too.
Yes. So there's, well, to the best of my knowledge, yes. I'd have to just look it up to verify, but that's never been an issue in this case.
Okay.
Never been an issue in that there's never been a denial that the debt exists.
That's right. That's right, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, it's in our pleadings. We don't deny that. We just say that the foreclosure was wrong. Never should have happened. Now, so I think everything turns on, in this case, whether we have a fact issue of judicial estoppel or not. And I'd like to read from page 18 of the appellee's brief, where they show the three elements which must be proven to establish judicial estoppel. Starting with the first paragraph at the top of page 18, the appellee, Wells Fargo, says, to establish judicial estoppel following a bankruptcy case, three elements must be proven. Number one, the party to be estopped has taken a position clearly inconsistent with its previous position. Number two, the previous court must have accepted the previous position, and number three, the previous inconsistent position was not inadvertent. All right, first of all, they contend, and we agree, that those three elements must be proven. So then that begs the question, well, was it proven in this case? Did they prove those three elements in their summary judgment motion? Well, number one, they can't prove that the party to be estopped has taken a position clearly inconsistent with its previous position, like was done in the Flores case. They don't have that in this case. There's no proof of that. All there is, the only proof that there is that they were still in bankruptcy when the foreclosure happened, and my clients endeavored to try to get that untangled, and the Wells Fargo representatives said that they would work with them to try to get this untangled, this foreclosure. So they haven't taken a position inconsistent with a previous position.
Mr. Peacock.
Yes.
Were your clients represented by counsel at all times during the bankruptcy?
I believe that they were.
They were represented by counsel at the time that you now contend that there was a verbal agreement to postpone a foreclosure?
The
July to August, I'm talking about.
Yes. Well, the foreclosure happened in July of 2011. And my clients were clearly under the impression from Wells Fargo's customer service representatives that the foreclosure was going to be pushed off.
A verbal representation and a telephone conference, and maybe verified by email.
Yes. And
legal counsel didn't, there wasn't anything I saw in the record of any legal counsel intervention at that point on the behalf of your clients.
I don't see that either.
Okay, thank you.
Now,
I'm coughing like I'm doing. I hope I'm not interrupting you, but I can't keep from it. And it doesn't have anything to do with what you're saying.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So I apologize.
That's just fine, Your Honor. Number two, the second element that they had to prove. The previous court must have accepted the previous position. Well, the court had ordered a payment plan that was already in place before the foreclosure ever happened. So there's nothing to show that the previous court accepted the previous position. And number three, and they have a incredibly difficult issue to try to prove number three. Now, the third element, the previous inconsistent position, number one, I don't think there's any evidence that they had an inconsistent position, but they have to prove the previous inconsistent position was not inadvertent. That flies in the face of all the evidence in this case. Our clients were trying to get this matter worked out, and so they didn't even, well, they didn't file the lawsuit. They weren't trying to make a claim. They were trying to get their matter worked out, like Wells Fargo said that they would work it out. So, number one, they were continuing efforts to do a joint rescission of the foreclosure. Number two, Wells Fargo filed the lawsuit to set aside the sale as being void, which is a judicial admission. So their big problem, the elephant in the room, so to speak, is the fact that they're trying to prove that my clients had a motive to conceal this claim. I don't see how they get there from here. They're trying to say and they have no proof of that. All they have is their statement that, well, it's self-evident. Well, there's nothing self-evident about the facts in this case, except that they were the plaintiffs. They brought the lawsuit. They were the ones that started contending that the sale was void. There's nothing in the record from our clients that ever made a contention prior to this lawsuit that the sale was void. They are the ones that came out with that. They filed the lawsuit, but we simply agreed with them. Yes, it is void. So.
Your time has expired, I believe. Wasn't the red light on?
I was looking at that red button, but I didn't see it come on.
It was on a little while ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
With that, I'll rest.
Okay, thank you. Response?
May it please the court. My name's Tom Luce. I represent Wells Fargo. I plan in my prepared remarks to address the waiver issue that we've briefed and judicial estoppel. Those are the two issues that I'd like to talk to the court about. Of course, I'm here to answer any questions that the court might have. I first want to talk a little bit about the salient facts that I think will inform the court's decision in this case. Wells Fargo worked with the Herons for a period of 5 to 7 years trying to help them get current on their mortgage. They took out a loan and they defaulted. This began in 2005 and 2006. Wells Fargo entered 4 forbearance agreements with the Herons. The Herons didn't make the payments under those agreements. That led to an initial foreclosure process that began in 2007, and the Herons filed bankruptcy to stop that foreclosure. In their bankruptcy, the Herons had an obligation to pay arrears on the mortgage and to pay the current payments. They defaulted on that. That led Wells Fargo to move for relief from the automatic stay. I believe that occurred in 2009. That led, as counsel alluded to an agreed stay order, which also required the Herons to make payments on the mortgage. They defaulted under the agreed stay order. I disagree with counsel about what was required under the agreed stay order. When they defaulted on December 23rd, 2010, Wells Fargo gave the Herons notice of default and an opportunity to cure, and they had to cure within 10 days. That was pursuant to the terms of the agreed stay order. Under that order, if they failed to cure within 10 days, the automatic stay automatically terminated. There was no requirement under that for 2 notices or anything like that. We've quoted the relevant language of the agreed stay order in our brief, and it simply doesn't require another notice. It requires 1 notice and a failure to cure, and if that occurs, the automatic stay automatically terminates. That's what happened in this case. After that, foreclosure proceedings were again initiated, but Wells Fargo gave the Herons another opportunity to cure their default. There was a foreclosure posted for May of 2011. But Wells Fargo gave the Herons an opportunity to get current again. The Herons promised to pay an amount of money. I don't recall the exact amount, but they promised to make that payment, and in exchange for that promise, Wells Fargo pulled down that foreclosure. The Herons didn't make that payment. Ultimately, in July 2011, the property was foreclosed, but the Herons continued to complain. And they said, we want you to rescind the foreclosure, and we'd like to do a loan mod. Wells Fargo sent them papers to effect a rescission of the foreclosure and papers to initiate a process for a loan modification. The Herons never returned those papers. From the very start in 2005 through 2011, the Herons were given numerous opportunities to try and cure, and Wells Fargo worked with them continuously, but they never did that. During the bankruptcy, the Herons never disclosed their claims against Wells Fargo. And when you look at their allegations and at the affidavit of Mrs. Heron, it's apparent that all of the facts giving rise to their claims occurred either before their bankruptcy, and this would be facts in the 2005 to 2007 time frame involving the forbearance agreements and the events that led to the initial foreclosure proceeding in 07, or they concerned the events that led to the foreclosure in 2011, the default under the agreed stay order, and the proceedings that led up to the July foreclosure. All of the facts occurred that give rise to their claims either before or during their bankruptcy, and they never disclosed that claim against Wells Fargo in any of their bankruptcy papers. That's the salient facts that the court ought to keep in mind in considering the issues in this appeal. The first issue I want to talk about is waiver. The trial court granted summary judgment but didn't state the grounds for summary judgment. Wells Fargo moved on a number of different independent grounds that would warrant summary judgment in this case. One of those grounds, as to each and every of the Herons' claims, was no evidence grounds under Rule 166AI. And I've cited in the brief the page references in the record where you can see for each of those claims the Herons alleged, we identified the claims, the elements of that cause of action, and the elements that the Herons had no evidence of. In their appellate paper, the Herons don't challenge the no evidence grounds for summary judgment. That's an independent ground for summary judgment that they simply haven't challenged, and I'll add one caveat to that. They asserted 10 separate issues on appeal, including their sub-issues. One of them says there's ample evidence to support their TDCA claims. I don't read that to directly challenge the no evidence grounds for summary judgment, but I know that this court and courts construe issues liberally, and giving them the benefit of the doubt, we have said in our briefs, okay, that's enough to challenge no evidence on the TDCA. With that caveat, they did not challenge the no evidence grounds for summary judgment as to any other claim. And there are two levels of waiver in this case. First, they didn't state an issue challenging no evidence grounds for summary judgment as to any claim. If you look at the 10 issues, it simply isn't there. They did not assert what I'll call a Mullooly issue, a ground for error that is simply that the trial court erred in granting summary judgment, which would enable them to brief any basis why the court erred in doing so. They didn't assert a Mullooly issue. Which brings me to the second level of waiver. If you look at the substance of their briefing, there simply isn't anything in their briefing that addresses the no evidence grounds. They don't identify the claims. They don't have citations to the record to show here's where Wells Fargo challenged an element and said there was no evidence, and here's where you can look in the record to see that there was evidence of that element. There's nothing in the briefing on the merits in their brief to do that. So there's two levels of error or of waiver there. In their reply brief, the Herons raise a number of arguments why the waiver doesn't apply. Their first argument is that they address both no evidence and the traditional summary judgment grounds in the trial court. But of course, it's what they challenge the judgment on in this court that matters. They also argue that they are appealing from the trial court's order granting traditional and no evidence summary judgment for Wells Fargo. But that just is an identification of the order they're appealing from. That's not an issue on appeal or a question raised on the appeal. Lastly, they say that their briefing was sufficient to cover all of the issues, but if you look at the substance of their briefing, they simply do not address the no evidence grounds. Because the trial court's judgment may be affirmed on any ground raised below, and because the Herons have waived any challenge to the no evidence ground, this court should affirm the trial court summary judgment as to every claim with the possible exception of TDCA on the no evidence grounds. The next issue I want to talk about is the judicial estoppel issue. Counsel argues that this is a different case because of the fact that Wells Fargo sued them and they were defendants, but that's a distinction without a difference. The Herons are asserting claims against Wells Fargo in the trial court, and those are the claims that they did not disclose in the bankruptcy court. As this court knows and is apparent from their Flores decision and other decisions in this case and from the decisions in the Fifth Circuit that we've cited, debtors in bankruptcy have a duty to disclose their interests in property. That duty is ongoing. It applies to contingent claims. It applies to potential causes of action. What they have said is they've asserted potential causes of action, or they've asserted causes of action against Wells Fargo. I was a little bit surprised to hear counsel claim that they had not taken an inconsistent position or that the bankruptcy court had not accepted that position. In their briefing, they didn't challenge those first two elements of judicial estoppel. As to the first element, inconsistent positions, of course they've taken inconsistent positions. By not disclosing the claims in bankruptcy, they impliedly represented to the bankruptcy court that those claims didn't exist. So in bankruptcy, there's no claims. Here in this case, there are claims. That's flatly inconsistent. The bankruptcy court did accept that position by its plan confirmation order and by granting the Herons a discharge in bankruptcy. The only issue that the Herons contested, at least in their briefing, and I believe that's consistent with the briefing that they filed in the trial court, is the issue on judicial estoppel regarding whether it was inadvertent. On inadvertence, this court and the Fifth Circuit has recognized that that is shown by either a lack of knowledge of the claim or by a lack of a motive to conceal the claim. The Herons don't seriously contest lack of knowledge. They were there when Wells Fargo acted or didn't act in whatever way they allege to be wrongful in this case. And so that really takes you to what is the heart of their challenge to judicial estoppel, and that is they say it was inadvertent, and it goes to their motive to conceal the claim. This court recognized in Flores, and the Fifth Circuit has held, that in the context of a debtor not disclosing claims in bankruptcy, motive to conceal is self-evident. And that motive is a financial motive where, as in this case, if the Herons were to prevail on any claim against Wells Fargo, they would get to keep that benefit for themselves. And if they had disclosed it, that benefit would be shared with their creditors. And so there's a financial motive of keeping that claim for themselves versus sharing that the proceeds of any claim that they might have with creditors. And the Fifth Circuit has held that self-evident. This court recognized that in its opinion in Flores. Counsel has said we have no evidence to show motive, and that's not true. It's a self-evident motive, and it is evidenced by the papers from the Herons' own bankruptcy case. They have, and these are in the record on appeal as well. They have their Chapter 13 plan, for example, which identifies unsecured claims, none of which were paid in their bankruptcy. Had that claim against Wells Fargo been disclosed, whatever the Herons might have gained from that claim would have been available to satisfy their creditors' claims, and that's apparent from the bankruptcy records that we've put in the record. And so it's not true that there is no evidence of the motive. The motive is both self-evident and evidenced by the Herons' own bankruptcy filings.
Excuse me. All right. The Herons say that Wells Fargo judicially admitted the foreclosure was void of filing their lawsuit.
I heard that.
And you're saying that because they didn't reveal their claim against Wells Fargo. They were defrauding the creditors if the claim existed, or attempting to defraud the creditors if the claim existed. Is that correct?
I'm not sure that it goes to defraud, but they concealed that claim from their creditors and had it
and
been...
the trustee and et cetera.
Then if the claim had merit, that claim would have been available to benefit the creditors.
But if the claim was their homestead, how does a homestead benefit the creditors since it's exempt?
Three things about that. The Herons say that the main asset in their claim against Wells Fargo was title to their home, which they say was exempt. That has a number of problems. First, the claim that they didn't reveal was their claims against Wells Fargo, not the title to their home. And it's those claims that the non-disclosure of those claims that set up the judicial estoppel.
Which claims aren't? I mean, it's whether payments were made, whether payments were excused, or tardiness was excused. Doesn't that all go to the homestead?
I'm not sure I understand your question exactly, but it's not that they had a homestead that wasn't revealed. They disclosed the debt to Wells Fargo. They did not disclose the claims against Wells Fargo. A second point, which this court recognized, I believe, in the Flores opinion, is the Herons took the federal exemption, not the state exemption.
Okay.
So even if their homestead could have been exempt under the state exemptions, they didn't take that. And you'll see that in Schedule C of their bankruptcy filing. And third, they didn't disclose their claims against Wells Fargo are not exempt property because they did not disclose that in Schedule C as well. And I'm saying Schedule C, I think that's the schedule for exemptions. I could be off on that. Lastly, even if you think you have an exempt claim or an exempt asset in bankruptcy, you as the debtor don't get to make that determination. Those determinations are often disputed in bankruptcy. The principle in bankruptcy is to disclose those claims and let the bankruptcy court decide whether or not it's exempt or not. And so that really doesn't get them anywhere. In their briefing, I know the Herons relied extensively on Justice Haynes' dissent in Love. And I see my time is up.
I have a question, Mr. Lewis,
yes,
before
you.
Even though your time's up, and I apologize, but I'm waiting till you finished. The damages that might have been recovered had the pleadings been correct about the TDCA would have been in terms of money damages, even on a multiple of money damages. And that's the claim that might have benefited the creditors if it had been a good claim.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
So the issue dealing with the title to the homestead was never a contested issue as to the existence of a lien against the homestead, and therefore the homestead question would not engulf the damage claims for the TDCA if those had been properly proven and money paid.
I think, if I understand you correctly, I think that's right.
I'm just saying those are two separate matters. The question of the title to the home, still burdened with the mortgage, was what was left to the bankruptcy court. It's a undisputed secured debt.
Yes, sir.
And then issues dealing with misrepresentations, fraud, the other elements that might have been involved in making a claim under the TDCA, the Texas Debt Collection Act, would have been for money damages according to the statutory scheme of whatever those damages might have been that could have been recovered, and that would have been the kind of claim that could have benefited the unsecured creditors.
That's entirely correct. They sought money damages from Wells Fargo. Those damages would have been available to satisfy creditors' claims had that been disclosed during the
bankruptcy. All right. Thank you, Mr. Lewis.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Mr. Peacock, you've got 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay, well, let's deal with the last issue first, and I appreciate the fact that the court has pointed out that there's a difference. Okay, arguably, they can take the position that, all right, some of the claims, possibly the TDCA claim that has a potential money damage issue, then if they can prove the judicial estoppel, if they can prove all the elements, then that claim would be gone. But they have a real problem on the claim to set aside the wrongful foreclosure. They agree that it was wrongfully foreclosed. So there is no way, in my opinion, that there are sufficient evidence of the items that they have to prove, which they've admitted in their brief, that they have to prove in order to establish judicial estoppel regarding the foreclosure of the home. They just don't have it. They can't get there from here. Now, regarding the schedules, if you would like to look at them, on page 524 of the record, it shows the Wells Fargo debt, the amount of the secured claim, the value of the property. And if you go to, then if you go to page 530, it shows the exemptions, and the Schedule C is property claimed as exempt. And you will see item number one, the homestead. So it's undisputed here that the exemption, that the property was listed on the exemption. So regardless of whatever the court does with the issue of, well, is the TDCA out because of judicial estoppel? Clearly, the foreclosure is not out. And there's just no facts to establish judicial estoppel other than they're saying that, well, it's self-evident that there was a motive to conceal. That's no proof. That's not proof, trying to say that, well, to me, it's self-evident because they're trying to recover the title to their property. So they just don't get there. They don't have the evidence, they don't have the facts to establish judicial estoppel regarding the wrongful foreclosure of their homestead. And that's really, as I said earlier, that's really the issue in this case. I should also point out they had some discussion about waiver. I think if you look at our brief, we haven't waived a number of the claims. Some of them, yes, we did waive, but not all of them. And certainly the foreclosure was not waived. The breach of the contract, et cetera, et cetera. I won't go through that again. But I would ask that the court find that they didn't meet their summary judgment burden on the foreclosure issue, and that the summary judgment should be set aside at least on that issue, and the case remanded for a new trial.
I have one question for you before you quit, Mr. Peacock.
Yes, Your Honor.
In terms of the pleadings initiating the litigation where the bank filed pleadings seeking to address the foreclosure, and your contention is that their pleadings were that the foreclosure was void.
Yes.
Now, ultimately, a summary judgment was granted in favor of the bank as against the debt and the way that the foreclosure was undertaken, those matters involving the proof of statutory compliance in Texas statutes. And then there was a non-suit. Was the part of the did the non-suit reach the contention that you say they contended that the foreclosure was void? In other words, were those pleadings a part of the non-suit where the bank was on your position contending that the foreclosure itself was void in the pleadings filed in the trial court? Did those go away with the non-suit?
My understanding of the court's judgment, when they the court's judgment says that it's judgment as to all parties and contentions, and so it was the judgment was total and complete, although they had non-suited their lawsuit at that point. That they did that later. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but I'm trying my best.
I appreciate your trying. Thank you for your response, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. You've been very helpful to the court, both sides. And we will adjourn the court at this stage, and you will hear from us before too long. Thank you very much for being here.